seriously, it's just, it's like me going, okay, I'm basically doing a Kickstarter for the Chocolate One project. Well, what I want to do is get a bunch of money and then build the moon out of Dairy Milk chocolate. Welcome to this week's episode of What Will Brian's Facial Hair Look Like This Week?
It's very mysterious.
It is very mysterious.
Yeah, it just kind of springs out of nowhere.
It's fascinating. Every time we do this show, it's quite different, I have to say. I mean, there was a kind of a Santa Claus bit going on a while back, and now it's all very...
I liked the Santa Claus beard, to be honest. The nerdy Jew Santa Claus guy was awesome.
Yeah, you've just
the last person I would ever want to see climbing down the chimney on Christmas morning is Brian Lincoln.
With a gigantic toothy grin.
Well, he's now got a but Van Dyke that he's drawn on an eyebrow pencil. So, gentlemen.
But more specifically, we are bad vaulted.
We are
not
vaulted.
Facial hair. Let's talk about what's on the show, shall we? I'm delighted to announce the news that Sam Hulick, who's a very well-known musician and contributor to video games, to movies, to film, TV, all kinds of stuff, he's coming on. He's going to come and tell us about his world, how he makes music, and why everybody should love it.
We're going to have the first 2% of a massive raging argument about whether you can actually make money if you're an open source indie developer.
And we'll also talk about the technological and ethical aspects of the Mars One project.
And then we're going to give some of our predictions for the cool things that will be happening in 2014.
Yeah. Now, we have so many predictions or so much idea of what... We're going to be so wrong that we're going to break this into two pieces. So we're going to kick off that for the first one on this show. So, Jeremy, what should we do right now? What should we do?
You know what we should do, Jono? Just start.
What should we do?
Bad Voltage.
A little while back, news hit of this crazy bastard called Baz Lansdorp, who started this this project called Mars One. And the basic goal here is to establish a permanent human colony on Mars. Now, this sounds like something out of Total Recall. and the way in which he wants to go about it is to have basically a one-way ticket to Mars, where, you know, some of these astronauts will go out to Mars. It'll take a while to get there, and they ain't coming back. And I don't mean that they're going to go and have a lovely life on Mars. It means that they are potentially going to, well, they're definitely going to die on Mars, but they may die on the way to Mars.
I was going
to
say, they might not even make it to Mars.
Right. So, you know, it seems like a pretty good deal all around. So he, you know, announced this, and then they, you know, they looked for... They looked for people to come and, you know, participate in this. Now, when I heard this, I was expecting, you know, there was going to be not that many people are going to want to have a suicide trip to Mars. But by the 9th of September, they had nearly 3,000 people had applied and paid their registration fee to do this. So the question is this just absolute insane science fiction? Are they actually going to be able to get there? Is the first thing. Second thing, is this okay? I mean, it's one thing for someone to say, you know, yeah, I'll go to Mars and I'll die on the way, but is that something okay for people to do? And then the other thing is this just a big kind of, is this just a big con or is it a real thing? Because there's some people out there in the space world, and I'm not a space dork by any stretch of the imagination, who think that this is a bit of a scam. What do you guys think about this?
I think it's complete and utter nonsense in the framework of how they've laid things out, because they're trying to raise, they said $6 billion, but anyone who seems to be really into the topic seems to think that that is massively, massively underestimating what they're going to need. And despite that, I'm shocked, but they've raised $172,000 to date, which astounds me. Now, that said, I think the general concept is an absolutely awesome one. I think we should go to Mars and probably will. I mean, Elon Musk is already on record saying, I plan on retiring to Mars. And he's a very smart guy who I would personally not bet against. This particular project, on the other hand, seems maybe well-intentioned, but kind of like a pipe dream.
Right. What do you think, Ak?
It's not a pipe dream. It's not just a pipe dream. It's a dream of not just a pipe, but a whole oil refinery, right?
It is the Alaskan pipeline of pipe dreams.
It's the Alaskan pipeline.
Seriously, it's like me going, okay, I'm basically doing a Kickstarter for the Chocolate One project. Well, what I want to do is get a bunch of money and then build the moon out of Dairy Milk chocolate. It is stupid on a level I barely knew existed.
Which is saying something.
I was going to say, right? I mean, there's a pretty high bar to clear. I mean, I have no problem with the fact that the people want to do it. I'm not surprised that it's got a lot of interest. And, I mean, there's something mildly compelling. If they're going to pick five people and send them off to Mars, even if you're going to die on the way there or die when you get there, there's a lot of people who queue up to take that risk. Why wouldn't you? It'd be cool.
Am I the only one that finds it odd that only four or five people are going and they're completely randomly, it's seemingly taking people, not the fittest or the most able to fix a spacecraft mid-space for a year. It's like ex-hairdressers and things
I would love to see at least the people they pick have nice looking hair
when the spaceship explodes.
To my mind, that's what I think's interesting, that if what you want is something where you've got the four or five best trained people in the world to fix this, then you're not this guy's project, you're NASA. NASA are already doing that. The whole reason why this is interesting is not that you can spend 20 years training someone, then they can go to Mars. You want to be able to just take a dude off the street and say, you can travel to Mars in the same way that you can travel to Buffalo. Right?
But do you think the first time you travel to Mars should be random people or people of the level? I would think the sad part here is that NASA is not doing this.
NASA aren't doing it. Agreed.
That's a separate thing. This is part of the reason. I think part of the reason why this struck me as being a whirring typhoon of bullshit is because part of the plan here of how they want to generate revenue is to make a reality TV show of the mission as well.
Which starts next year. They want to start the actual show.
Well, you see, I don't think that's a stupid idea at all. There's a shed load of money out there in this sort of thing.
There is, but I mean, it's like they're picking a bunch of random people who are not trained in space flight to make a reality TV, and they're going to basically put them on board the world's largest rocket and fire it at Mars, right?
Well, yeah, but
I mean, it's like something out of Austin Powers. I mean,
well, of course it is, but that's the beauty of it, right? That it's thinking really, really big. This is, as far as I'm aware, the only project in history where the phrase "it's a moonshot" is literally an understatement, right?
Yeah. Do we think it's going to even happen? Because they charge registration fees for people who are going to do this.
Of course, it's not going to happen.
No, but what I mean is they could have a crack at trying to raise the funding, right? NASA said that for an austere manned Mars mission, it was going to cost a projected $100 billion.
Yes, right? Exactly.
Now, they've raised, admittedly, what, about 200 grand?
And this is the point. And even if they say, you know, we're going to work on radically different ways of doing it and we don't work the way NASA does, and what they eventually end up saying is, we're going to send five people and we're going to get 100,000 guys on push bikes pedaling at the bottom of the rocket or something, then fine, whatever.
$172,000 is probably not enough money to buy the amount of Tang you would need to make it to Mars.
Not only will they not get the amount of money they need, they won't get within three or four orders of magnitude of the amount of money they need.
I am waiting hour by hour to see who the crack team of astronauts they have picked from this group would be. Because they're probably going to pick a team. If it's for a reality TV show, they're probably going to pick a team in the same way that One Direction was manufactured, right? They're going to have like the edgy guy, and they're going to have the pretty boy, and they're going to have all these different roles. I would love to see the
Actually, if this Brady means bunch. Getting rid of Bieber, I would say I hope it happens. Let's put him on there.
Well, yeah, but, you know, I mean, it's nice to think that Someone is putting together a project where the idea of going to Mars is actually within the range of ordinary people, like we want it to be, rather than some 20-year trained test pilot who can bench press a Buick, right?
But I think the odds of that second guy making it are slim to none, so the odds of the first group of people making it are infinitesimal at best.
Well, the point is, I don't believe they're going to get anywhere close to the amount of money.
But I really would like to see humanity doing these kind of projects again. Like I said, I think it's a net loss for everyone that we're not doing moonshots anymore. That's why I think Elon Musk is...
Totally agree with you.
So, I mean, didn't the original... One of the original moon projects, didn't they fix one of the computers with like a piece of gum and a...
Yeah, well, absolutely. And that's the beauty of this sort of thing.
They fixed it with a piece of gum? No,
I think they fixed it with a piece of gum and a paper clip or something. It was something crazy. I don't remember the exact story, but...
In this case, they're going to get to Mars and someone's going to be like, did you remember the map?
Right. Space travel's inspirational. I mean, I freely admit it's less inspirational if what you've picked is five Northampton scallies from a reality TV show and made them the first people in human history to walk on the surface of another planet. But that's not the point.
I mean, if I said I was going to raise $6 billion to swim to the bottom of the Marianas Trench, would you think that was like, oh, wow, that's awesome. I wonder what's down there.
Well, it's inspirational. I donate to your Kickstarter.
In other news, apparently the president is going to be sent to an asteroid to mine it as well. So it sounds, I'm going to try and pick up on the subtlety of this discussion, that it sounds like we don't think it's got a lot of merit to it.
I applaud the basic idea. I like the idea of doing something unimaginably huge, because that's one of the big ways that progress is made. However, I think even on the scale of unimaginably huge projects, basically kickstartering the world's first manned mission to Mars is a bit of a reach.
Yeah, this project is
bit of a reach.
So in this segment, the group is going to discuss how can indie developers, and specifically indie open source developers, make money? And I guess part of the question maybe should be, can indie open source developers make money? Now, Brian, I want to start this off with a question for you, because I know that you recently made Linux Tycoon and the Illumination software creator Shareware Plus open source after a brief attempt at just making it open source. And I should note here for the listeners, it started out proprietary.
Right.
So can you tell us a little bit about that experience as an indie open source developer attempting to make money? And I know you've kind of tossed multiple different ways around. What's your experience been here?
So it actually is a fairly simple thing. So I took the software I make, and I won't really go into it because I don't want to plug it a bunch, but I took the software I made that was fairly successful when it was proprietary and shareware, and successful enough to support me, my family, additional artists working on it, and the occasional additional consulting developer. So it was a full business. When I took it and made it open source, I initially wanted to make it open source and basically just have it community supported through donations, through selling swag and things like that. That failed phenomenally well. It was just like a gigantic napalm bomb of disaster. I tried it a couple of different ways. I tried doing fund drives. I tried doing subscription services and support subscriptions for it. And while those systems work really well for enterprises, they just don't work at all for consumer-oriented software, for games, for dev-type software. It just doesn't work at all. And, you know, I also sell my software like through the Ubuntu Software Center and things like that. And none of the existing software centers currently have the numbers that are there of total users buying software to actually support independent developers. They're just not getting high enough sales numbers. So what I ended up trying to do was saying, okay, well, why not make it shareware, but also make the source code available up on GitHub and the like. And all of a sudden, sales went back up to their previous levels, and people started buying the software at a level enough where you could actually support continued development full-time on them, which kind of surprised me. I assumed going shareware plus open source would just fail phenomenally, just like open source plus donations would have.
Yeah, it seems to me that there's two things here. One is Do people who are interested in open source want to spend money on open source? Is question number one. Right. And then the second question is, I totally believe that people can sell open source software, independent developers can sell open source software and make enough money to go out and have a couple of beers on a Friday.
Oh, that much is easy. But yeah,
it's making enough money, I think, is the thing. Like, the real determining factor is, could someone make enough money to support their family?
Yeah, and can you make as much money as you could make?
I mean, what would you say to both of those?
To be completely fair, it's not terribly doable right now. I cheated. I'm not the most famous person in the world, but I have a large audience. And if I hadn't had that large audience, there is no way in Sam Hell I could have pulled off what I pulled off. There just isn't. If I hadn't right. had...
And you have an audience and a back catalog of existing software, which exactly. gave you kind of a double.
If I was starting with... let's say I was making a game. Let's say I came out with Linux Tycoon right now, and no one knew who I was. I was just some random guy. I might get a little bit of a boost because of the random quirkiness of what Linux Tycoon is, but outside of that, I probably wouldn't have gotten the press attention I got, and I wouldn't have gotten the sales I got. And so it's just really hard.
A thing I wanted to kind of clarify here almost, when your various pieces of software, Illumination, Linux Tycoon, whatever, were being sold as proprietary yeah. commercial stuff, you presumably had a particular audience of people you advertised to, that particular audience, people who bought it.
Right.
When you went open source, the impression I had is that you stopped pitching to those people and started pitching to people who cared primarily about its open sourceness.
You know,
is that the case? Were you
really,
going?
It's really
was it different audience?
One and the same. For me, they were always really the same audience because for me, I was Brian Lunduk. I mean, my audience was always a very Linux-centric audience. So while I made software for Windows and Mac, the vast majority of my sales were always for the Linux versions. So the target audience really never changed. In fact, nowadays, I sell more towards Windows than I do for Linux, which is a strange thing for me because it's both open source and shareware, whereas when it was just proprietary, my sales was always higher to the Linux market, which doesn't even make sense to me.
So then clarifying an additional thing, you said your revenue went through the floor when you went open source. Did yeah. the number of downloads also go through the floor?
No, the number of downloads through the roof.
Right, so it was still being used by at least the same number of people. It's just that when it went open source, they just didn't have to pay for it. But when they had, so it's a product that people think is worth paying for because they paid for it beforehand, they paid for it after the open source experiment.
Right.
But while it was open source, they just went, well, here's the thing I'll be prepared to pay for, but I can get it for nothing.
Correct.
Check it out.
That's exactly
it. Get it for nothing.
Yeah. That really is right. exactly it. And what I noticed was people weren't going to, say, the Ubuntu Software Center and buying it either. They were finding additional routes to get it, even if it took two or three extra steps, even if they couldn't get it from a repository, they were willing to take those extra steps in order to not pay for it, which
it
was
seems,
sad.
It seems as well that there is almost another model here, which is what I would, there's probably another term for it, but I would coin as careware, which is people who make software for the good of, you know, keeping the project going, and they look for donations. Like, a good example of this is Ardor, the guy who writes Ardor, the Ardor multi-tracker. Right. He works full-time in it, and he basically says,
not really.
I can do this
not
while
really.
You people give me donations.
So Ardor, if you look at his numbers, he brings in something on the order of around $2,000-something US per month for Ardor, which he has to supplement his additional income from doing consulting work and contract work and the likes. Now, his example is one of the most successful examples of consumer and prosumer-oriented open-source software, and it's a piece of software. It's a multi-track audio editor that it is essential and amazing. And despite its criticalness, it still can't really get much past that $2,000-ish per month of coming in from donations. And that to me is a major
concern.
And
that's a really good program that's been around for a really long time.
Exactly. It's amazing.
Yeah, that's
it's
setting the bar
huge
phenomenally
community.
High.
Exactly.
But would you say that that's it's a mature piece of software, but it's still very niche, right? I mean, if somebody came up with a very popular game, for example, do you think that that would be different?
It is.
Because I can imagine if someone created, let's say, a really popular first-person shooter or a really popular puzzle game.
Well, here's just as an aside.
Arguably,
I don't think it's that niche. So look at the amount of commercial software in that space making massive amounts of money.
Look at Cubase. I mean, look at our interview to this, you know, this episode is with a musician. Look at all of the musicians. Software that costs a ton of money and that has many, many competitors in the market and are produced by companies of, you know, anywhere from 10 employees to hundreds of employees. And what we're looking at with Ardour is something that's really put together by one guy plus a small crew of part-time volunteers, and it can't really produce much more than $2,000 a month despite its amazingness and despite its overall market presence. That's a major concern. But on the flip side of that, though, it's not that open source causes things to not be successful. It's that the models of generating revenue that are common around open source tend to not be successful and are difficult to maintain. Yeah.
So that actually brings me to an interesting point, I think, is does anyone on the group see either bounties or the recent kind of crowdfunding trend, be it dedicated sites like Bounty Source or kind of Kickstarter, Lighttable used it and Ghost used it. Does anyone see either of those models as sustainable open source revenue models?
Bounties are useless.
I agree. Bounties are useless.
The reason bounties are useless, right, is I know what I charge people for custom development work. And that'll get you a day's work, whatever. And if someone said, okay, here's a bounty, we need someone to build this thing, and the bounty is $5,000, then fine, no problem. But the way all these bounty things work is someone says, well, what I want is I want a fully world-spanning, fully encrypted IM system ported to all platforms and open source, and my bounty is $300.
Well, you're saying the current bounty system is unrealistic, but do you think bounties in general is a sustainable system moving forward if it was ironed out and done correctly?
If anyone is actually prepared to pay market rates in a bounty, then yeah. But at that point, you don't need a bounty. If you're prepared to pay market rate for a developer to do a thing, what do you need bounty source for? Well, just go and hire a developer and pay them.
Yeah, well, that's different though. I mean, for bounties, not everyone who is going to pay a bounty. Like, there's a lot of bounties who are done by hobbyists as a means to earn pin money.
And that's very cool.
And that model can work. To me, the reason why bounties don't work is because I could say to Brian, I'd like you to build this feature into Ardour, as an example, if Brian was a hacker in Ardour, and he would build that for me, but there is no guarantee that that's going to land in the code base. And once the bounty's over, I'm pretty much guaranteed that he's not going to maintain it. And that's the reason why bounties don't work.
This is exactly my point. You get, because you've paid for a thing, if you ask someone to do it and someone else shows up and they do it, but they don't do it, go hire you. Imagined, or it takes them longer to do than you wanted, or they finish half of it, then it's okay. Once you've paid some money to someone and they've accepted money to do it, that excuse of, well, I was only doing it out of the goodness of my heart, goes out the window. So there's this kind of, I paid you to do this thing going on, but you didn't pay them wages to do it. You paid them pin money.
You know, this is a topic we could go on for hours about. At least I know I could. What we might need to do at some point is, you know, get someone like the main developer behind Ardour and sit him down with all of us and me, and we can just kind of hash it out for a little bit more. Because I think, honestly, ongoing throughout 2014, this is going to be kind of an interesting topic.
So now on the show, we've got Sam Hulick, who has been very, very active in the games and the entertainment industry. Sam is based out in LA, is BAFTA nominated and NBC News award-winning composer for film, television, and interactive media. Now, we have a lot of people who listen to Bad Voltage who are big gamers. So if you've played Mass Effect or Baldur's Gate, Baldur's Gate 2, you know, these are some examples of some of the tremendous work that Sam's done. So Sam, thank you for coming on the show. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Fantastic. Now, so let's kick off with what most gamers, I think, are going to be wanting to know. Like, how exactly does your work fit into the wider work of a studio? So, I mean, you have all of these different components in a game. You've got people who are doing the animation, people who are doing, you know, the storytelling, and they're doing the programming. And then, of course, you've got the speech and the music and all the rest of it. How does the development process work, and at what point do you fit into it?
That's a good question. Usually music is really towards the very end, you know, post-production process. in most cases, by the time I'm brought on board to write music, the game is usually, it's almost always in a playable state. not finished, obviously, and quite buggy and crashy.
Right.
I think, you know, nowadays it's easier for game developers to just cut video clips of levels and scenes and send them over to us. For Mass Effect 1, actually, they did send me home with an Xbox development kit. and they would send me...
Interesting.
Yeah, they would send me builds of Mass Effect that I could load up and play through. But I don't know, like that just, it gets kind of complicated when, you know, you go out to the client, you fly up to Canada and you come back with the Xbox dev kit through customs and they're like, what is this thing? Especially now, it's like, you know, this looks fishy. It's like an Xbox, but there's this like giant thing attached to the top. Is that a bomb or like, what is that? Yeah, so I'm brought in very late in the process, and like I said, they'll send video clips of scenes and levels, and I'll write music to that and send it in. And there's usually, on my end, some level of like a conscious effort to deliver the music in a way that the audio implementers can take like layers of music that I've written and program it into the engine so that it's interactive. So if more enemies show up on the screen, extra layers of music are activated.
Now,
I have
just one question. When working on Mass Effect, is it that your music inspired them to have more alien lesbian sex, or did the alien lesbian sex inspire the music?
This guy's good. He's got the tough questions.
Yeah. I'm a hard-hitting journalist.
That's one way of describing it.
He asks the questions that no one else is willing to ask.
Yeah. So how do you take that one?
Yeah, but don't dodge this question, man.
I don't even know. The steamy alien sex scenes come first before the music. So they send me these scenes and I have to watch them several times, obviously.
Obviously. You're forced to, right? At gunpoint.
Yes. It's a terrible, terrible thing to have to watch these videos. But those come first. But I don't know. It's funny because in a franchise like Mass Effect, they're sending artwork for us to write music to, like, you know, levels and concept art. But by the time that we've reached, like, you know, Mass Effect 2 or 3, teams are using past music as inspiration for artwork. And so there's this kind of this cyclic, what's the word I'm looking for? Like symbiotic relationship. Yeah. Yes, back and forth between the composers, on Mass Effect and the artists and writers.
Nice.
It must be odd when you're you're tasked with creating music that you obviously want to be iconic in this game, and the game is about atmosphere and building a scene. It must be unusual to be doing that with something that's not complete yet, or to take some of your inspiration from imagery and things like that. Like, how do you get yourself, I know this sounds like a very cheesy question, but how do you get yourself into that mental zone to create your best work based upon that fragmented picture that you've got to work with?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. It is difficult at times because, you know, when we're sent scenes from the game, there are oftentimes not finished visually. They're like rough renders. And so, you know, like what the player sees in the end are these grand scenes, these cinematic landscapes and explosions and everything. And like what we see early on in the process is, you know, like these half-finished 3D models, like, you know, they're supposed to be wearing like body armor, but they're just wearing like these weird jumpsuits that are like solid, like pajamas, just like solid colors, and they're like they're shooting at giant triangles and cubes. It's really kind of bizarre. So you definitely have to use your imagination to some extent, and kind of put yourself in the world. And the concept art helps a lot too. There's like fantastic concept art done by the artists. They really help in helping to immerse you into their environment.
One of the things that I think's interesting about the music stuff in games is it's often the difference between a relatively mediocre game and an amazing game. And the same thing applies to films, that the music can really elevate something into excellence. Look at, I mean, your work on Mass Effect, even something like Chipsel's stuff for Super Hexagon. For games writers who want to get that level of excellent music into their games, but aren't themselves musicians, how should they go about finding people to team up with? Where do you find great game musicians?
They should call me. They should all call me right away. you know, I don't know. It's really, that's a tough question. I've never been asked that question before. I mean, really, it's the game developer in a way is like a director, and they have they should have a vision of what they're looking to accomplish in their game, how it's going to fit into, you know, the story and the art style. So it's really up to them to just go out and find examples of composers' work that, you know, resonates with them, and finding someone who, I mean, really, it goes beyond just the art too. It's not just how the music sounds. It's also a very personal thing. Is it someone who is likable, who's easy to work with? That's such a big deal, because they're, you know, sometimes you work with someone who might be very talented but is not so easy to work with, and that can obviously lead to trouble. Right. So,
yeah,
it becomes this kind of challenge to find an overall package of someone who is talented and easy to work with.
That's the holy grail right there.
Yeah, yes. We've all got some experience of that. So a lot of people listen to this show, obviously, very interested in technology, and this is a question that's for them, but this is almost entirely selfishly from me as well. I'd love to know, like, what exactly do you use in terms of technology to create your soundtracks? I mean, what software, what hardware are you using on a daily basis? What are your tools of the trade to create what you do?
Sure. I am on a Mac Pro. It's my main workhorse. My sequencer, my music sequencer, is Cubase. It has been for quite a while. I've been through a few different ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went up on Cubase. It's funny how things have changed over the years. I started off on a Windows machine using Sonar.
Right.
And I kept getting this is back when Windows was not quite as stable as it is now. I was getting blue screens and crashes, and I just couldn't deal with it. So I jumped ship and switched to Mac, and I was on Logic for a while. And that was cool for a while. Then I switched to Cubase, and I was like, wow, what have I been missing all this time? So Cubase is my home now. And I have a whole slew of different sample libraries, you know, like full orchestra stuff, strings, brass, winds, percussion, synthesizers, really, I mean, even beyond that, just bizarre stuff. I have like a sample library of a human thigh bone flute, which is like the most macabre, dark, crazy thing. I don't know. I saw it and
that's a thing, it turns out. Okay.
Yes, it is a thing. I used it in what was it? In Baldur's Gate Enhanced Edition. And they're like, hey, that's a really cool instrument. We should use that again.
Yeah.
But yeah.
What do you use for the strings? I mean, do you use like Hollywood strings or Vienna strings or?
I use a mix of things depending. I mostly use one called Cinematic Strings 2.
Okay.
I also use LA Scoring Strings as well to supplement that. What else? I use Cinebrass for my brass section. Percussion is Spitfire. Woodwinds is Berlin Woodwinds, which is an amazing library. And actually, the guys behind Berlin Woodwinds have strings now that just came out, and they sound great. And they're actually working on brass. They have a whole basically orchestral ensemble that they're working on. So really excited about their stuff. Is really excellent.
And is pretty much everything done? Is everything done on a computer, or do you record live audio ever? Do you do choruses and things like that?
Most of the stuff I do is in the box. It's computer based. There are times when, you know, a score will call for live instruments. You just can't really replace them. Especially I find in with like solo instrumentalists, like you have a solo violin or cello. It's just, you know, when you have a sample, they do a very meticulous recording process where they'll record every single note basically in the scale that an instrument can perform, as well as the intervals. So they'll play like they'll record the person playing C to C sharp, C to D, C to E, and basically so that when you switch between those notes, you get a very connected sound, which is, it sounds realistic, right. But you don't have the emotion behind it because you're not, you know, they weren't presented with a score and an idea and saying, here's the mood, please play this. So when you go to a live instrument, right. A live orchestra, like for a film or something or a game, and you tell them what's going on, they can play with emotion, and that's really the way to go. As long as there's a budget for it, I always like to include at least solo instruments, live solo instruments on top of a sampled score. It really helps to up the realism.
One of the things that I thought was interesting is I saw your name pop up, Sam, when you offered to help write the startup sounds for Ubuntu, which I think is fantastic. I like the idea of having the sounds on my personal desktop be built by you. That's great. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. First of all, I'm a big fan of Ubuntu for many years. I think the first time I tried it was maybe 8.04, like way back when. And I don't know, one day I just thought, hey, it'd be kind of cool to write the startup sound, like the official startup sound for Ubuntu. So I tried to get a hold of the right people. It took a while, admittedly, but eventually I got a hold of the right people. And it sounds like they're interested. And actually, we did a test run. I wrote some ringtones, a couple ideas, I think, for the Ubuntu Touch operating system. And one of them made the cut, and it's on the phone. It's called Samsung.
But is that because, you know, it's Sam who sung something, or is it like, you know, big Korean manufacturer?
I was going to come up with a name for it, and I was thinking, and they beat me to it, and they're like, well, here it is. It's called Samsung. I'm like, okay, that's fine. That'll work. It's good enough. It's straight to the point. But they actually just emailed me a couple weeks ago, and they said, hey, we are getting started on thinking about like sound for Ubuntu 14.04 LTS. And are you still interested in doing the startup sound? So I said, yes, definitely. And I'm not talking directly to Mark Shuttleworth, but they're relaying messages, I guess, back and forth. And we've talked about different ideas. Some people, you know, in the community feel that startup sounds are sort of antiquated. Like they don't want to hear something every time the computer boots up. They just want to hear nothing, or maybe a couple chimes like Windows 7, for example. So we're trying to, I don't know, like brainstorm and figure out what would be a good approach. I think one idea.
Who doesn't
want to
hear the sound of a headshot when they boot their computer, you know? I mean,
that'd be brilliant. One of my favorite stories of all time, I have no idea whether it's actually true, but I hope it is that Brian Eno, I think it was Brian Eno, got asked to pitch for some work for Microsoft. This is back for Windows 95. And he got a spec saying, we want you to build a piece of music which expresses the hope of a new generation and helps people to understand that they're entering into a new thing. And this is something better than before. You know, the whole page of requirements at the end it said, and it has to be less than 4 seconds long. is that the kind of pitch you've been asked to deal with?
That's hilarious. No, I did not know about that. I knew Brian Eno did several of the Windows startup sounds, but that's really funny. I think they're pretty open about what they want to do. I think more of the pickiness comes from the community, people who use Ubuntu, and they're like, you know, it should be this way or this way, and there's a lot of different opinions, and I think the bottom line is like you can never please everybody. You know, there's someone who will just not like what happens.
Sam, you've got it all wrong. Our community never picky about anything, not once. Okay, in all seriousness, I think I've heard every week for the last 7 years. When are you going to change the startup sound? When are you going to change the startup sound? So when you made this kind offer, I was absolutely delighted. It's like, not only are we going to get a decent startup sound, but we're also going to get, you know, we're actually going to solve the problem, but it's actually going to be done very well. So thank you very much, by the way. On behalf of Canonical and the Ubuntu world and my sanity, I really appreciate what you're doing.
Well, that sounds very official. Hopefully this podcast now will like lock me in so they can't not use my music, right?
Oh, you're locked in now. Sorry, it's official now. You're one of us.
That's right. Yeah. Excellent.
Yeah, you're the Brian Eno of Ubuntu. Welcome. So just pulling this in to a conclusion, I think a lot of people who listen to this will think of you as having the dream job, right? I mean, you've made it in the games world. You're actively working on big game titles, of which many of us are fans of. How did you get started in this? Give us a quick summary of how you got started and give us a couple of tips for someone who wants to do what you do and how they can be successful as well.
Yeah. Well, I would say anyone who wants to do this for a living, don't run away. Turn around and run. It's really hard, actually. It's quite difficult. There's a lot of rejection involved. I mean, you really have to have thick skin because there's so many projects that composers pitch for, and we don't really talk about it. But you know, we're asked to pitch on projects, and we oftentimes don't get them. It's very difficult. I basically just, you know, I have a self-taught musical background, and I realized the music and games was evolving, and I wanted to make a career out of it. And so I just spent a lot of time honing my skills and a lot of networking. I recommend anyone who really wants to get into writing music for games on a serious level should probably go to the Game Developers Conference every year.
Right.
That's really key. And people will go sometimes and expect, you know, great things to happen after the first visit to GDC, but really it's all about repeating visits and coming back, and you know, people get to see your face every year, and it takes time. It's really not a career for anyone who's impatient, because it takes a lot of patience and time and cultivating relationships, and you know, I guess you know, paying your dues in a way, and just getting face time with people. But yeah, I just got in through a lot of networking you know, whatever you can do to get your name out there. There was a contest that I was part of where you had to write a piece of music, and I won that contest, and that contest resulted in me getting hired to work on my first video game, actually. That was back in 2003. So, right. You know, those little things that you do to help get your name out there, and people will start to hear your stuff, and that's really what it's all about.
So be creative and be persevering.
Exactly, pretty much. Yes, and hardworking and thick-skinned.
Well, fantastic. Well, Sam, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate you taking time out of your busy calendar to come and join us for an interview, and all the best for 2014.
Thank you. Yeah, my pleasure. Yeah.
So this episode, in lieu of the normal review section that we do, we are going to do some 2014 predictions from the group. Now, so prescient of a group this is, we've decided to break those predictions up into two episodes. So in this episode, Jono and I are going to go through a couple of predictions that we have, and then next episode, Eck and Brian are going to get their crack at their 2014 predictions.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we should specify the rules around this, and Eck mentioned this just before we started recording, is that each of these predictions has got to be in some way measurable, right? Back,
yeah.
Do you want to outline that in a little bit more detail?
Assuming that we're doing a review our prediction show a year from now, I want to be able to look at them and then say, Jono predicted this thing, did it happen? And not have an argument about whether it happened or not. So the rule is your thing has to be measurable enough that we can unambiguously say whether you got it right or not. Otherwise, what happens is we all go, no, Jono's prediction that everyone would start eating nothing but crisps didn't happen. And Jono goes, oh, but it did happen. And then we have a big argument. So we're trying to avoid that.
Which would be bad, because we don't like to argue on bad voltage.
No, we do not. Measurable predictions. Them's the rules, kids.
All right, so I'll start it off here, yeah. So my first prediction is that Kanye West will not in any way, shape, or form be all the rage in 2014. But Bitcoin will be adopted in some major way by at least one financial institution. And by that, I mean either Bitcoin accounts at a major traditional bank or proper support at a major brokerage. And I think cryptocurrencies in general will be treated more like an asset class than a currency.
That's fair. There was a discussion on the forums on community.badvoltage.org about stuff that might happen in 2014, and someone there said the same thing, that Bitcoin will be adopted by. But so we can reasonably agree on what a major bank is, right? You know,
yeah, we're talking BOA, yep. Scotland, something of that.
HSBC, yeah. Jeremy's Discount Bank of the Reformed Straight Lines, Buffalo, does not count.
Right, around the brokerage side, say a Goldman Sachs, a Merrill Lynch, something of that level.
And you're expecting to see me be able to open an account in and denominate it in Bitcoin?
Or properly trade at a major brokerage.
Kanye West will be less relevant in 2014, which would be a good thing for everybody.
Correct.
Man, did you see that video with him and Kim Kardashian? Oh, Jesus.
No, I said Kanye West, not Kanye West.
Oh, I thought you said Kanye West.
Oh, well, no, there's an actual cryptocurrency called Kanye West.
Oh,
I believe he sent them a cease and desist.
Okay.
Oh, man.
Yes. Okay.
I thought you meant Kanye West as well, because I was going to point out that would make Kanye West less famous than Bitcoin. Which is pretty humiliating for an entertainer.
All right. Right.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Well, no, I mean, Jeremy's welcome to make that prediction. It's difficult to describe the magnitude of his wrongness, but okay, great.
I think, we're used to it by now, aren't we? So, so next up, my prediction is going to be that the major consumer-facing software companies today, so I'm going to include Microsoft, Apple, Google in that mix, every one of them is going to have some form of wearable product in 2014. That might be a watch. It might be a fitness thing. It might be a Google Glass type thing. It's going to be some kind of wearable technology. Right,
I was going to say Google already does.
Google already have that. So you're defining this as Microsoft and Apple do this?
The major consumer-facing companies.
I would include
Google, Samsung, Microsoft, Apple. I think it's going to be wearable technology is going to be a big thing. That's going to be out there. It's going to be on sale. Google Glass right now is still in its Explorer program, but it's going to be out there. Everyone's going to be invested in wearable technology.
I'm going to be able to walk into a shop on the high street and buy an Apple wearable thing, a Microsoft wearable thing, a Samsung wearable thing, and a Google wearable thing.
So you can already buy two, and I think Apple's a definite. Microsoft's the only wild card there to me.
I think I think wearable tech is where it's going to be at in 2014, and those are my more specific measurable aspects.
That's fair. I mean, you think that's exciting.
I don't think it's exciting. I think it's going to happen, though.
I think the Internet of Things is going to take off more than wearables, personally. I think Google's acquisition of Nest, it's kind of the beginning of that for the year. Stepping on my predictions.
What a crock of shit. Anyway, carry on.
Stepping on my predictions for the next show. Shut up.
Stay tuned for Axe Compendium of Bullshit in the next episode. Right. Meanwhile, back at you, short man.
I think 2014 is going to be an inflection point where both online privacy and online security become absolutely mainstream to the point that our parents care about this, and I think that means possibly regulation, good or bad. And I think it's going to be caused by kind of a confluence of what we learned with the Snowden leaks, and then massive breaches such as what we had with Target recently.
Oh,
hang on. So,
how is that measurable?
How are we measuring this?
It's going to become a mainstream issue, so you'll see it on CNN or BBC, and average people will care.
So the measurable thing is a constant pulse of news on major news sites, basically.
And people about actually care. Not only that, but people actually caring about it.
Right. I think that's reasonable.
That's reasonable, yeah. If my dad or people we meet in the pub or whatever say, oh, you're in technology. What do you think about blah?
Yes.
And are we talking about intrusion against protecting against government intrusion against privacy, or is Facebook the offender here, or both, or neither, or what?
I think both online privacy, which would kind of be on the Facebook side, and then security, which would be on both the private and government side, I guess. I think they'll both become major issues where people actually care, because right now I think it's clear, unfortunately, people don't care as much as they should.
I certainly agree people don't care. I can see us having an argument about how some people care a year from now, but I think that's reasonable. So, okay. And
I actually zoned out while listening to you guys talking about that.
All right,
so
go ahead there, tall man.
All right. I thought your prediction, Jeremy, was going to be, in 2014, it's going to be okay for guys to wear heels.
Anyway,
I was under the impression that you already wear them.
Oh, well, yeah, I do from time to time.
Well, sure, you look very handsome doing so. So
you can get flip flops so. With heels, can you?
Fuck off. All right. So I believe that my next prediction is a bit ambitious. It's two pronged, right? I believe that 2014
you're gonna do a Kickstarter and send people to Jupiter.
I believe that 2014 is going to be the year of virtual reality in gaming, and the way that's going to manifest is that Sony and Microsoft are both going to have virtual reality headsets. I think Nintendo probably won't, but I think that more specifically, all of the major studios will have at least one virtual reality game in development or released in 2014. I think there'll be an industry-wide commitment to virtual reality in 2014.
And we're defining,
we might not see the games, but we will see a commitment.
We're defining a virtual reality helmet as something which takes over your whole vision and provides a fully immersive 3D view.
Yeah, so basically the Oculus Rift, but I think there will be a Sony headset, there will be a Microsoft headset, there will be the Oculus Rift that will mainly be of interest to Steam. It wouldn't surprise me if there's a Steam
headset. You think that will happen in 2014? A product that nobody's mentioned yet is going to go to the point of being... There's not even any rumours about it. Is going to go to... In the next 12 months.
I think that Sony will definitely release a headset. The Oculus Rift will be out. I think Microsoft will at least either announce or release a headset in 2014. I think there'll be another one, but each of the game studios will have committed to titles that will likely ship later.
Okay. That's
I can see the latter, but the former is not going to happen.
Let's see how we look in a year, short man.
Wow.
See, you know you're wrong, so you got to keep going to the fact that I'm 1.5 inches shorter than you.
Maybe.
We are being very unfair. I mean, Jeremy was going to lend me some money earlier, but it turned out he couldn't because he was a bit short.
He actually has to stand on a box to record this show. So
I'm sitting on multiple boxes now, actually.
right, so that's
I'm going to throw in a wild card bonus prediction for you.
Oh, wild card.
Wild card.
Go with the wild card.
As competitive as the mobile industry right now from a phone OS perspective between Ubuntu Touch, which I'm sure will take over the world in 2015, and all the other ones, I think the biggest competitive focus in the handsets this year is going to be battery life, not technology.
I do think that's going to be bigotive.
Hang on. What? What does the biggest competitive focus mean, Jezza?
I think you are going to, while in the past years you've seen either new versions of Android be the focus or ridiculous thumb scanners or a lot of stupid stuff, I think you'll see Samsung, Apple, HTC, the majors, in their commercials, will be touting battery life as a competitive advantage.
So people are going to explicitly release phones which don't do anything over the previous model other than get better battery life.
Well, don't do anything would be a little disingenuous. They will not just ship the battery exact life phone will be the from feat. Last year with a bigger battery, but it will be
but battery will
one
be
of
the focus,
top
right?
feature things will say bigger battery life, yes.
What an unbelievable pile of steaming shit that
right, is. No. Because let's be clear, out of all five of those predictions that you guys have for 2014, that's the only one I would actually like to see happen.
We'd all like to see it happen, but I'd also like to see people go to Mars as well. And we know what we think about that.
Right. So check back in the next show for the other two sets of predictions.
Check back for regurgitating my second prediction.
Ah, and in the meantime, give us your comments on the forum on community.badvoltage.org. Your thoughts on, first of all, what you predict, and secondly, what you think of ours.
I think the most important thing that we could do right now, the most important thing in the entire history of humanity, is to stop recording this freaking show. I want to thank everyone for hanging out with us. Let's see, what should we remind people of today, gentlemen?
Well, we could remind them of your shameless fanboying of Samuel Egg, I have to say.
It'll be difficult to forget.
Dude,
that.
Sam is a pretty man, and he makes pretty music. I don't think I need to be ashamed of it at all.
I think you need to be ashamed of a lot of things, but that's not one of them.
No, I agree completely with Jono on this.
Now, I would also say that our listeners, our good listeners, have probably got a lot of feedback about areas in which Brian should feel ashamed. So so you can go to community.badvoltage.org and you can share your thoughts on the show or ways in which Brian can improve his facial hair or,
and
you know,
please,
improve his life.
Please. Please, in the forums, make the topic of the forum, Brian should feel ashamed because ... That would really just warm my heart.
I know that you need a little bit of attention sometimes, but this is not
I
the
do.
Way to go
it makes me feel happy.
Yeah, so a good show. You know, thank you for all of you lovely people for listening. I guess we'll see you in a couple of weeks for more predictions. We'll have someone else that we're going to talk to, hopefully, in terms of an interview. And yeah, we'll see you on Bad Voltage next time.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening.